Welcome back to the program. To thine own self be true, Shakespeare tells us. Little did he know that in calling for this, he was going up against centuries of evolutionary behavior. In fact, our guest today, renowned biologist and anthropologist Robert Trivers, argues that self-deception has been favored by natural selection, that we lie to ourselves in order to be better able to lie to others, and to the liars go the spoils. Today we're going to look at this phenomenon with Robert Trivers. He's a professor of anthropology and biological sciences at Rutgers University. He's winner of the Crayford Prize. He was recognized for his fundamental analysis of social evolution, conflict, and cooperation. It is my pleasure to welcome Robert Trivers here to talk about his book, The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Self-Deception in Human Life. Robert Trivers, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you here. It's really interesting as you sort of look at this, on a certain level, this notion of self-deceit and lying to ourselves in order to better enable us to lie to others, and the success that that has historically brought from an evolutionary perspective makes perfect sense, and yet it's something that we've always been so reluctant to acknowledge or much less to embrace.
Quite true. And self-deception itself, if you check out Western thought, has been a mystery from day one. And there have been various pretenders to the throne, so to speak, people that claimed they were putting together a scientific theory thereof. But none of that withstood the test of time. Freud had some interesting concepts regarding self-deception, no question about it: denial, projection, ego defense mechanisms, reaction formation, so on. But this was wedded to a thoroughly corrupt view of human development. He was just making stuff out of whole cloth, oral, anal, Oedipal, these stages. And so when you combine that with his analysis of self-deception, he often got things exactly upside down. He did the very thing that he was attributing to others. The classic case is that he had women come to him. And this is Victorian times, late 19th century, and they were complaining of inappropriate sexual advances by close adult males, like a stepfather and uncle, that kind of stuff. And we know now that such behavior is very common, but Freud decided it could not be so common in this class of people, and then he inverted things and said the women were fantasizing that they would get these relationships with close relatives, and that, from a biological standpoint, is most dubious, because we know there's been a long period of selection against females having sex or reproducing with close male relatives. The selection on the males to avoid it is much, much weaker. So he ends up blaming the victim and projecting onto the women the very thing he's denying of the men.
Also, in this age of obsession with memoir, where our remembered past is argued to be the truth, it really does call into question all of these issues.
Well, absolutely. We know that memory is very malleable and unreliable. Mark Twain famously said, "My memory is so good I can remember things that never happened." And that's really true of all of us. We think of memory as like a photo that gradually gets more blurry and less precise over time, but that's not, in fact, the way it operates. Memory is continually being reconstructed, and it's very easy for people's memories to become false and biased in systematic ways. So, yes, basing too much on memoirs doesn't sound like a great idea to me.
How much of this comes out of this ego defense mechanism that you talk about? And that has some strong evolutionary antecedents.
Well, ego defense mechanism is a broad term coming out of Freudian theory, that these are mechanisms the ego uses to protect itself from unhappiness, from adverse opinions of others, and so forth and so on. And this is very consistent with most modern psychologists who continue to take what I call a defensive approach to self-deception. So they think it's our way of defending ourselves from forces that would make us unhappy, as opposed to seeing it, as I do, as an offensive strategy. It's designed the better to fool others, and it is not, its primary purpose is not to make us feel better or protect our ego from this or that.
In some ways, it also helps us repress painful memories.
No question about it. But we know from the work of Jamie Pennebaker, University of Texas, that repressing painful memories may be a bad idea. And indeed, sharing trauma has been shown convincingly now to be associated with immune benefits. So the classic experiment is you bring some people into the lab, you ask them to think about the most traumatic thing that happened to them. The worst would be sexual abuse when they're young. It could be physical, you know, very harsh parental style. Maybe you got beat twice a day by your father, or your parents got divorced when you were young. That's often very traumatic to children. Whatever it was, they were to try to identify the most traumatic thing in their life. Then the group was split in two, and half of them wrote for 20 minutes every day for three straight days on the traumatic incident. The other half wrote about what they did that day, so they're the control group. Now, what was remarkable was this. The mood of those writing about trauma went down. That's not surprising. They're dwelling on something that's painful that they normally avoid dwelling on. However, their immune system, which is a very important system protecting us from disease and so on, that started to get better from day one. And then 3 months later, their immune system is still elevated, and now their mood has started to catch up. That is, now their mood is better than it was at the beginning. Meanwhile, those who are just writing about everyday events, they're just flatlining throughout. Their immune system's not changing, nor is their mood changing. So one very important result of this work is that mood follows the immune system in this case, not the other way around. It's very conventional for psychologists to imagine that if you are more optimistic and that's associated with a better immune functioning, then that's one of the functions of optimism, is to make your immune system work better. But it's actually almost certainly the other way around. When your immune system's working really well, you've vanquished any parasites and so on, you're naturally going to feel more optimistic. You're in better shape, you know. So in any case, back to the trauma, sharing trauma with others, probably even sharing trauma with the Lord in prayer, is immunologically beneficial. And we know that the most harmful kind of abuse or trauma when you're a youngster in terms of adult health is sexual trauma. People that have suffered from sexual trauma have a whole bunch of kind of disease problems in adulthood, which relates to the fact that their immune system is compromised. And it turns out that of all the different kinds of trauma you can suffer, the one you are least likely to share with anybody else is sexual trauma. In some samples, half the women have never discussed it with anybody. It's a shameful event when it occurs. They're confused. They can blame themselves. They can be inhibited from approaching a parent. Let's say it's a stepfather, and so in order to get some help, you've got to turn in your stepdad to your mom. She may disbelieve it. I've seen such situations with my own eyes where she's just denying the thing because she doesn't want to face what's really happening. And so the child, without support, senses it and never tells a soul. And that's harmful.
How does this work with respect to groups that deceive themselves as a group and create a kind of group false narrative?
Well, now that's a very good question, and that's begging to be explored by historians and other people, you know. I can only speculate, as I do in the book, that if you can get a whole group of people aboard on, as you put it, a false historical narrative, then you have a powerful force to weld social cohesion. So if the Germans said to each other in the 30s, wir müssen Lebensraum haben, we have to have room in which to live, like the great German people is being compressed into an unnaturally small space, if you get everybody signing aboard to that delusion, then it's pretty easy to combine it with marching orders and say, well, let's start expanding. Let's start invading neighboring countries and so on. So, yes, group cohesion is often produced with these false historical narratives. We're watching an effort in the U.S. now, which fortunately doesn't seem to be catching on, but it's absolutely astonishing the amount of garbage and nonsense economics that's being peddled by the party that wants to come back into power. And, you know, are people going to buy this nonsense? Are they going to buy the nonsense that if we increase modestly the taxes on the wealthy, which used to be at a much higher level, and we used to be much more prosperous at times of high marginal taxation, contrary to what's often asserted, they call this class warfare. My God, class warfare is when the peasants grab their pitchforks and head to the king's palace to confront him. Class warfare is not begging a slight rearrangement of the tax schedule so the rich people start to pay a fairer share. They don't even pay a fair share now for all the bleeding of those that support them.
One of the things you do talk about, though, is the way in which this self-deception, individually and even in small working groups, can have tragic consequences, and you point to a number of disasters that are directly attributable to this kind of behavior.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can give you examples from, say, let me just give you airplane crashes. We all fly in airplanes, so we all have an interest in this topic. And here's one interesting fact. 80% of all accidents occur while the pilot is flying the airplane, even though in reality the pilot flies roughly 50% of the time and the co-pilot flies the other 50%. Now that's a counterintuitive fact. You say, well, ain't he the pilot? Doesn't he have more experience? Isn't he presumptively the better flyer? To which you answer yes to all those questions. So then why does he crash more when he's flying? Now, a number of lines of evidence suggest strongly that the problem is one of dominance in the cockpit. So if the pilot is sufficiently dominant over the co-pilot, and this was dramatically illustrated for a period of time in Korean Airlines, where they naturally have a very hierarchical structure, then the co-pilot may be too timid to speak up and correct the pilot. And there were literally a couple of dramatic and completely unnecessary crashes of Korean Airlines planes because the pilot's so timid, he says, well, pilot-san, or whatever the honorific term is, I really do think we should correct our movement slightly, blam, and they're into the mountain because he's waited way too long and he's been too timid. So the solution in the case of Korean Airlines, they brought in consultants and they acted to change the dominant structure in the cockpit, even encouraging them to speak English and not Korean, because English didn't have the built-in hierarchical structure to it. It's worst when pilot and co-pilot are flying for the first time and the pilot is flying, because then the co-pilot is least likely to speak up. Let's say you and I are pilot and co-pilot, mm-hmm. Jeff, and we've known each other quite some time, then I'm the co-pilot. I'm relaxed with you. We're friends, you know. I can say, hey, Jeff, I really think, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And you can say, Robert, good point, or Robert, I don't agree with you. So statistically, it's very, very dramatic that the worst possible situation for you sitting in the back of the airplane is to have a pilot flying with a co-pilot that he's flying with for the first time.
How has this worked, I mean, to just continue this for a moment, with
sure.
both the space shuttle disasters, which also relate to this?
Oh, Lord. Well, the space shuttle disasters illustrate self-deception at a higher level than, say, the cockpit, which is what I started out with in my chapter on airplane crashes. I analyzed a famous crash 30 years ago, and then I became something of an expert on the subject, was consulted by the U.S. government on cockpit conversations and so on. But in any case, in the case of the space disasters, what you have, and Richard Feynman, the famous mm-hmm. physicist, was the first to produce the appropriate analysis when he sat on the commission to investigate the Challenger disaster. And after locating the O-ring as the key defective product, in the spacecraft, he said, how on earth could a $5 billion bureaucracy create such a shoddy piece of work? And when he delved deeper, he discovered that the so-called safety unit of NASA had been completely corrupted to serve the purpose of maintaining frequent flights. Indeed, the whole logic of NASA was to have expensive, frequent manned flights, whereas everybody knows that unmanned flights produce much more useful data of all kinds, and manned flights are more or less stunts, you know. And indeed, in the Challenger disaster, they had a school teacher aboard, Christy McAuliffe, and she's going to teach from space a class to fifth graders. Well, the day they were to fly was unusually cold, and people knew that the O-ring was sensitive to cold, although the safety unit had managed to hide the statistically significant fact from themselves and from the upper links. So there's an analogy almost between an individual practicing self-deception, in which you keep the truth in the unconscious. The conscious is got falsehood, but that's what you're trying to peddle to others. So in this case, the top echelon of NASA is like the conscious mind, if you want to run the metaphor. It's peddling this product to Congress and to the country, and it's a crappy product. So it don't want to hear anything about the downside. You know, they literally asked the safety unit to compute the chance of a disaster, and they came up with 1 in 70. And NASA said, "Woo, that's way too high, redo it." And they came up with 1 in 90, which is actually a sign of integrity because they're under pressure. So that NASA just reclassified it as 1 in 200, and then they decided that's too high, so they just arbitrarily classified it as 1 in 10,000, which is... Feynman pointed out, an utterly fanciful figure. So in any case, it turned out that the initial estimate of the safety unit was dead on the money when you added in the Challenger and the Columbia disaster. It turned out it was 1 in 64 flights blew up. But you can see the dynamics where when the safety unit produces an honest result, the upper echelons just reclassify it off into fantasy land, that you could fly one of these contraptions for, what is it, every day would be 360, and then times three, well, for 30, for a month, I guess, you
right.
could. You could fly one of these damn things, or whatever it is, and you would only have one crash, and it was utterly fanciful.
Go back and talk a little bit about the evolutionary biological basis of this, that if we look in nature, we begin to understand how this bias towards self-deception really came to be.
Well, I guess there are two components to that, Jeff. First of all is to recognize from a study of creatures in general, how pervasive deception is as a feature in life. It's found at all levels. Bacteria will imitate our body parts to slip through the immune system's detection system. HIV changes its coat pattern, protein coat pattern, regularly. In fact, so quickly that the organism can never mount an immune defense against it because the coat pattern has gone and changed, and consequently it evades it. So there are all kinds of endless strategies between parasite host, predator and prey, but also within species. We know that animals, insects, birds, humans, monkeys routinely deceive each other, and they get an easy natural benefit in theory. Let's take a male and a female. I can be married and tell my wife, Maria, that I love her to death and I would never look at another woman. And meanwhile, I have a child down the street by another woman. Or in Maria's case, I may have a child with another woman right in her house that she doesn't know about. So as long as detection's undetected, you can gain a benefit from it. And likewise, Maria can present me a baby and say, that's yours, when it's not hers. And there are plenty of situations in which it's better for her in principle to get her genes from a superior biological source while getting parental investment from her husband. And there's a nice Senegalese folk expression that captures this from the man's standpoint, and that is better to have an ugly child that resembles you than a good-looking child that resembles your neighbor. So deception is pervasive, but self-deception, by logic, we think, relates to the fact that consciously mediated deception is both cognitively expensive, which itself gives off cues. You pause too damn much while you're dreaming up the lie. You can't meet another person's gaze while you're thinking up the lie, not because you're nervous, but because it's too hard to think up the lie while looking someone straight in the eye. So you tend to look off into the distance. You give away your lie by your voice rising, because whenever you tense up yourself, Jeff, you automatically tend to push your voice up higher, and we tend to tense ourselves up in the key word in a lie. I remember a woman who was denying to me a homosexual relationship with another woman, which I was not accusing her of, and she said, "You think I'm there with Sherry?" And her voice, you know, leapt up two octaves because it broke on the key word. And I thought to myself, well, I did have a theory, and now I have more evidence supporting the theory, you know. So then the whole point is, if you're unconscious of your deception, if you're not aware that you're practicing it, then those kinds of cues, like your eye movements or the quality of your voice or unnecessary pauses, they may all be unavailable to the observer. So it's easier for them to... it's easier for the deceiver to get away with it. Even the unconscious mind will help you think up the damn lie in the first place, so you don't have to sit there and cogitate consciously in front of someone while they're watching this pause as you invent the lie.
Mm-hmm. And then there's this correlation between deception and intelligence.
Yes, indeed, and I like it very much. Because I think it runs a little bit counter to people's presumptions, which is if you think you're smarter, and everybody thinks they're smarter than they actually are, most people do. But in any case, let's say you think you're smarter, then you say, "Well, damn, I'm smart enough where I don't need to lie, and I'm part of my smartness is that I'm honest with facts and evidence, and so I don't practice lying and so forth and so on." So if anything, if you're smarter, you're expected to practice self-deception more when you lie, to hide from yourself what you're really doing better. But in any case, the correlations are clear. In children, if you've got a smart child, the child's more apt to lie, period. And this has been shown experimentally in the lab with four-year-olds in a very nice experiment where a child's in a lab with a little box behind it, child sitting in a chair, the experimenter puts something in the box, child doesn't see it, closes the box and said, "Hey, I'm leaving the room for 2 minutes, do not peek, do not peek." Then they leave the room, watch through a one-way window, and most children peek. Then they come back and they say, "Did you peek?" And most children lie and say they didn't. But it turns out it's a function of how bright they are. If you give them a little cognitive test, if your child is bright, he or she lies in that situation 100% of the time. If your child is slow, 65% of the time. And likewise, we know from the study of monkeys and apes, the bigger the brain, and especially the social brain, the more often they're seen acting deceptively in nature. And finally, we know developmentally in children that as they become developmentally more astute, you know, from ages 6 months to ages 5 years, their deceptions become more subtle and complex, you know. So I don't think there's any doubt that there's a positive correlation between deception and intelligence, at least in those, you know, we don't have the evidence for adults. It would be very nice if someone produced the evidence. And then it's presumption or assumption that we may, and I just put it that way, we may practice self-deception more the smarter we are, and we would easily imagine or wish it were otherwise, but I'm suggesting it isn't.
Where does the role, and I know you talk about this a bit, the role of humor and satire in puncturing self-inflated deception, how does that play out?
Well, that's a very good question, Jeff, and it's an inadequacy of my book that I'm not quite painfully aware of, but certainly aware of, that I have very little to say about laughter and humor. The main things I say are actually from some scientific work that are suggestive. But I do think that humor often plays the role of puncturing deception and self-deception, and that is then very humorous to us. Exactly how it works out, I'm not sure. But just to give you a trivial example, when everybody was saying about President Clinton, what would the founding fathers think if they knew that a future president was having sex with an intern? Chris Rock said, well, they were having sex with their slaves. So that's the kind of contradiction that people are not attuned to when they're busy coming up with nonsense about what would the founding fathers think. But by simply pointing out, hell, forget about interns, they were having sex with their slaves, undercuts this moralistic outrage that's supposedly coming from the founding fathers right down to this day.
Of course, coming back to where we started in terms of memory and recall, the fact of the matter is that we tend to recall our successes more, and the winners get to write the history.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No question about that. In Japan, where they fought rear guard action, fortunately largely a losing action, but at the highest levels of society, to not admit that they ran not a huge forced whorehouse in World War II, but a huge system of sexual slavery. These women weren't getting any money. They were grabbed in Indonesia and the Philippines at the point of a bayonet and then forced to service 60 or 70 Japanese soldiers every day. A dreadful, dreadful chapter in a pretty dreadful history of behavior by the Japanese people before and during World War II. So anyway, it was only under pressure from the women who eventually came out in the 1990s. But what I wanted to mention was that the conservatives who were trying to protect Japan's image, they said the history you're referring to was victor's history. In other words, the story you're telling was the story told by allies after they conquered Japan, and that's perfectly true. For example, the Dutch were in charge, so to speak, of Indonesia at the time. It was a colony of theirs. So they damn well investigated this forced sexual slavery business and made sure that it was written into the history of Japanese behavior. So that's a case where more accurate history was written by the victors than the losers would have written about their own behavior. But in general, you're absolutely right. Victors write the history, and they'll tell any damn story that suits their own self-glorification and also, lack of responsibility. For example, if Israel continues to maintain the fantasy, and I've been shocked to go to meetings in New Jersey where some rabid partisans on behalf of Israel are arguing that the Arabs ran away voluntarily during 1948, during the war there, while the Israelis, nascent Israelis, did everything in their power to try to keep the Arabs to stay, whereas there's nothing like that at all. It was a case of ethnic cleansing, and it's very, very well known. It was planned ahead of time. It was carried out systematically, and 700,000 Arabs were driven out of Israel, and they formed the population of Gaza and some of the West Bank. And by denying the truth, well, then you don't have to pay reparations. You can deny a right to return. You can get all kinds of benefits by writing a false history of that era.
Robert Trivers. The book is The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Self-Deception in Human Life, just out from Basic Books. Robert, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.